Good afternoon. It's Dialogue Conspiracy. This is program 141, I believe we counted. It'd be 3 years this May. In a couple of weeks, we'll have an anniversary. 3 years I've been on the air doing this program. And it's April 22nd, I believe. Yeah, April 22nd. Okay, we'll talk a little bit today about the SLA, probably most of the 45 minutes, as I have a lot of material to keep up on that subject. We had a running commentary on the Watergate from June 17th when the men broke into the Watergate Hotel, Washington, D.C. in 1972, and that took up a great deal of the news on our programs. And of course, the Patricia Hearst kidnapping is going to escalate into a major continuous news story for many, many years to come. This isn't the end. This is only the beginning. So those of you that listen to Dialogue Conspiracy are getting these shows right from the very beginning of the kidnapping and prior to it with the shooting of Dr. Marcus Foster. And I continually refer to it as the biggest story in terms of power moving in the United States since the assassination of John Kennedy. The powers that be that make the decisions in this government can't run a law and order campaign anymore, because the law and order chiefs may spend some time in jail. They're getting a little slap on the wrist at the time, but the big boys still may go to jail or lose their law degrees, and one may be impeached. So, but as far as crime in the streets, you can run a beautiful campaign like Hitler did. And crime in the streets, if you have the military and the army and the police department with you, can go on until they get their beloved police state. And that's what the Patricia Hearst kidnapping is about. The SLA is moving south into our area in terms of gossip or rumor. It's natural that it should. California is ripe for these large conspiracies that are planned out of criminal conspiracy section of the Los Angeles Police Department that Agent Louis Tackwood referred to as going up and down the state of California. And Santa Cruz was a natural place for these multiple crimes. It wasn't a coincidence that these massacres took place, these staged massacres of the Frazier, Mullen, and Kemper, of killing the students, the hitchhikers. The campus at Santa Cruz idealistically started out to be a place to study humanities. And humanities is not what a military-industrial establishment needs. And you take these children of the rich or the minorities, and they're out there trying to understand under the redwoods what happened to their world preceding a certain period of history and what's in the future, and you have to come down on this whole class and discredit them. And you do it by staged multiple murders and violences and sweeping these beautiful people off the streets and threatening them with death and making them fearful not only of each other, but the community turned against them. So the internal domestic war we're seeing is moving now from San Francisco to the home of those other massacres in Santa Cruz. And I understand that the FBI is thick in the Santa Cruz Hills, allegedly looking for the SLA. And there was a rumor of an escape car, if we find a green car, down here in Monterey last week. A getaway car, don't touch it for fingerprints, and don't disturb it and follow it and turn in information. That gives the law authorities a lot of leeway to come down and move south to bring involve the whole state. I had another traumatic experience, which is part of this behavior modification, the kind of thing that Bleedy, the author of The Exorcist, is so good at doing for Army intelligence. I went to the store in Mid Valley in Carmel today, which is a small postal station set inside of a drugstore, and posted up on the wall is a picture of a little child about 7 or 9 years old who's missing from Seattle, Washington. Now, Carmel Valley, the post offices have been asked to post her picture up and down the coast of California. And right away, it makes you think that maybe these children are all in danger. There's danger everywhere. I wonder, what is this child in Seattle posted for? Because there's so many missing at different times that have never, the police have never been able to find right in their own locality when they were actually murdered there. But it is a suggestion that we're into terrorism. It's a carrying this thing across the borders, across the states, so that Carmel Valley could have a Seattle child down in our area, and the suggestion that this wide kidnapping will someday be linked to the Hearst kidnapping. It offended me because they know very well that that child is not going to be found at Mid Valley in Carmel. Last week when we went on the air on Monday, we were talking about a bank robbery. I just came into KLRB when the news on the Monterey Herald said a bank robbery in San Francisco and several people were shot, and I mentioned on my program, you can be sure that that bank robbery will be linked to the SLA. And I had in mind the British bank robbery. The agent Kenneth Littlejohn has exposed that he was hired by British military intelligence, which is identical to American intelligence. They're really one large body that work together and exchange agents back and forth. Kenneth Littlejohn was hired by British intelligence to rob a bank of $260,000 he took. And the purpose was to make it appear that the Irish were doing it as an excuse for stricter laws and punishment upon the Irish. So I knew that that bank robbery in San Francisco, coming upon all these killings and the Patricia Hearst story, they would find a way to link it to the Hearst kidnapping. But never in my wildest dreams did I believe that we would see the following day a picture of Patricia Hearst holding a gun as if she were a hardened criminal and a bank robber. And that picture, of course, the San Francisco Chronicle Examiner on Sunday, the magazine news section, had a full page picture of Patricia Hearst holding a gun and then a full page article on the bank robbery. Well, the police in San Francisco have had a series of killings, a rash of them recently, a total of maybe about 60 since the early fall, including Oakland area and Palo Alto up in San Francisco, the Bay Area. So the police are very thick in the area. They have command centers. The FBI have spent in their special troops. The special forces have arrived from Vietnam. Some of them have arrived over there. The military are all over the place. So San Francisco is pretty well covered for looking supposedly for the SLA. And we know that there's a lot of people on the lookout for bank robberies or getaway cars. But nine members of the SLA, nine, not one or two, visualize this. I mean, that's a motley crowd. A man as noticeable as Donald DeFries, whose picture has been posted everywhere the last 8 weeks. Donald DeFries and eight members of the SLA decide that they'll go off and get a little money for food. You know, this is the story. They may need the money for food to keep themselves going. So they just decide it's a nice spring day, they'll go heist a bank. So they go into a neighborhood bank where not one of the nine has ever been seen before. And they know what time it opens. The bank opens at 10, but at 9:50 they arrive because there's a window that candles them at 9:50. And they know what drawers the money is in. And they photograph beautifully, about 1,100 pictures. They're very photogenic. And there's a new thing going on with crime in San Francisco. The people announce who they are. They say, we're the SLA, and a girl says, I'm Tanya Hearst. That happened also in a case where a man was murdered last week, and a woman was assaulted, raped many times, was left to be dead. And supposedly, this is the story, as he's raping her, he's telling her that he's an ex-convict from the Potrero House, which is a home for a halfway house for convicts who get out of prison, that the neighborhood's objected to. The idea of them living in this community, the neighbors are terrorized. So this further increases the fear in the neighborhoods of having ex-convicts out on the streets. So while he's raping her, he's supposed to be identifying himself. This is a new kind of crime. You know what I'm leading to. It's all a bunch of baloney, but it's selling good until somebody really investigates this case. And because the FBI are thick in Santa Cruz today, I hope they're listening to this show, and I hope the police are listening to this show, because you're really pulling a lot of phony things on us, and it's not even funny. It's almost funny, but it's not. So these nine, four in the getaway car and five of this motley crowd who are identifiable, pictures have been in the paper, go into this bank and announce who they are, and they don't shoot out the cameras, and nobody presses an alarm or anything like that. And Patricia Hearst has a gun in her left hand, and her right hand is tied down. And then they leave, and it's a week today, and not one of them is found. Now, James Smith, the manager of the bank, these are his quotations. He said, it was done in such a precision-like manner that they seemed to have a knowledge of the bank. They knew where to go and what to do. Smith was wondering how the bandits knew that the two tellers' drawers looted were the only ones open before 10 a.m. when they arrived at 9:50. Now, the women involved, their names were listed, Nancy Ling Perry, Camilla Hall, and Patricia Salzik. But the newspaper bothers to say Nancy Ling Perry, in quotes, former North Beach topless dancer. Again, they don't tell you she was a Goldwater girl that graduated Whittier College and the English department of UC Berkeley. They want to come down on pornography. They want to come down on the social workers or prison reformers. So the name after Nancy Ling Perry, they give you, she's a topless dancer. They don't tell you she's a Goldwater girl, you see. Then Camilla Hall is described as a one-time social worker, but they don't tell you any connection she could have to a possible intelligence operation. Of course not. And then Patricia Ms. Moon Salzik is described in the bank robbery as a prison reform worker. Now, she didn't do any reforms in the California prisons. And because of what Ms. Moon did, the men are feeling more oppressions than ever, and soon all the doors will be closed off to any of us to visit or write if we don't expose this whole SLA for the fraud and the criminal conspiracy it is. So the cover story is a topless dancer, a social worker, and a prison reform worker. We're robbing a bank to discredit people who actually want to dance topless or be social workers or make prison reforms. Now, the manager went on to say there was increasing speculation yesterday that bank robbery was staged to provide funds for their latest covert, for their latest efforts. Well, I turn it around and say it was perfectly staged for other reasons. Yes, Mr. Bank Manager James Smith, it was staged, but not because they need the bread to live off. They have enough bread. They're not going out public, nine of them. They may go out to the grocery store and kind of get something, but it's really conspicuous to try and pull a bank robbery where they know there's cameras. The newspaper said the bank bandits made a point of mentioning their name. They also said, we're discussing the possibility that it was staged. We are amazed that they didn't shoot out the camera. Perhaps they wanted to be seen and they wanted her to be seen. Well, that's exactly the script. They wanted her to be seen. They wanted the tapes where she called her father a liar to be heard. They want to show America what happens to a girl who meets up with ex-prisoners. And there's a lot of messages in the Patricia Hearst kidnapping that we've talked about on the program before. Now, in the Chronicle this week, there was also an article titled, A Door-to-Door FBI Quiz Around the Sunset District. Now, the Sunset District is where they're trying to track down the clues to the SLA after the bank robbery. And the car was left in front of a getaway house. A green station wagon was left parked in front of a pink stucco house. The address was 2330 Lawton Street. And somebody made the comment that the police chief of San Francisco, Donald Scott, formerly lived in that house, and they said, I wonder if they did that on purpose. So I'm asking the question, how close to the bank was the getaway car abandoned? What bank did Police Chief Scott use for his own banking? How long ago did he move from the house? In other words, he may have moved from that house last summer, but he still keeps an account in that bank. In other words, did Police Chief Donald Scott ever bank at the bank that was robbed last Monday? Because it's important to know who knew those drawers, who knew the bank opened early. Somebody was very familiar with that bank, and the person that was familiar with that bank assisted these people. And because a agent of the British intelligence was told how to rob a bank and did it for a political and social purpose, somebody has instructed these people to rob that bank. And I wonder if Police Chief Scott in San Francisco ever banked at that bank. That would be an interesting question. Maybe he didn't, but I think it's something you have to ask. Now, this week, since we were together sharing our information in this last week, there was another article, new clues surface in the Hearst kidnapping. And it goes into the fact that evidence was in the hands of the police department 3 weeks before Patricia Hearst was kidnapped, that her name was on a list and that she could be kidnapped. And on these shows before, I brought up the fact that if the police department and the FBI or other authorities didn't make a connection between Donald DeFries and Joseph Little, all the months that DeFries had walked out of Soledad, they had 3 weeks to make the connection, and they would have prevented the Patricia Hearst kidnapping if they didn't want it to take place. Joseph Little was imported from Florida, and he's the man who is being charged with killing Dr. Marcus Foster. He connected with a man from Pennsylvania named Willie Wolf, who's 22 years old. Willie Wolf was attending a class, an extension course, of Colston Westbrook. Maybe you know these names by now. You should get used to them like you learned a new vocabulary 2 years ago. Dean Magruder, Colson Hunt, McCord. We have a new vocabulary cast of characters. Little came from Florida and met with Wolf. Now, there was a black cultural association in the California prison systems that was set up by CIA agent Colston Westbrook. And Joseph Little visited Donald DeFries many times in Vacaville Prison. And when Donald DeFries was moved to Soledad, he wrote the Department of Corrections, Joseph Little, asking for parole for DeFries. And in March 1973, when DeFries walked out of Soledad, I wouldn't dignify it by calling it an escape, when he walked out of Soledad, the authorities had from March till June, which is 11 months, to ask Mr. Little if he was harboring a criminal who had escaped from Soledad. Now, Little was arrested January the 11th as a suspect for murdering Dr. Marcus Foster. So the police authorities, the FBI, the California authorities had Little as a suspect 25 days before Patricia Hearst was kidnapped. Now it turns out this week that from the time Little was arrested, they had a notebook that said Patricia Hearst Campbell, Patricia Campbell Hearst at UC, the daughter of Hearst. Now, these are instructions because they would know she was at C. So they have at UC, daughter of Hearst, junior art student. And it goes, they use words of teams. They refer to teams and guns and action. And they list the names Yolanda, Camilla, David, and Margarita. Now, all of these people used aliases, but Camilla Hall was the name of one of the girls. Now, the police had this information, and they did not go to Patricia Hearst. It was just any student registered on the campus where it says a UC student, and it gives the major so you could find the department, a UC art student, it gives the year a junior. The police could have gone to the university and said, look, Patricia Hearst, we don't know why your name is on this list. But it's on the list, but they knew why. A man who was suspected of murdering Dr. Marcus Foster, who had written letters to the California Department of Corrections for an escaped convict who was supposed to be so dangerous he was capable of kidnapping. He was wanted on a kidnapping charge, and he was wanted on a possible murder charge in New Jersey, and the police department in L.A. had this information. So that you have one man who they're accusing of killing, and they have an escapee who's a friend of his who's staying in the house and knows the same people that Joseph Little does for 3 weeks, and the police department doesn't go to this girl. Her mother's on the board of regents of the university, and they have 3 weeks to make the connection between a potentially dangerous criminal and a man who's been charged who has her name on a list, and the police department had it 3 weeks, and they don't do anything about it. And furthermore, when Mr. Little, Joseph Little, was arrested, he was arrested for killing a black man, a school superintendent, Dr. Marcus Foster. And the names in his cottage and the names of the people with him involved a list. They had the names, and they even bragged about killing him. But you notice there has been no arrest warrant for any of these names in conjunction for killing Dr. Marcus Foster. None of these white people that were brought in from Indiana or from Florida or have been named as part of the conspiracy to kill Dr. Marcus Foster. And one was an escapee from prison. And you compare that to a federal case that just was concluded this last week, a lengthy case. A known killer by the name of Ronald Beatty was in prison down in Chino, and he offered to work for the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the police departments to break up Los Venceremos, which is a Chicano group, a politically a radical group in California. So they wanted to break up. The Chicanos were friendly to Ronald Beatty, so he offered to frame them, to have a computer bugging device implanted under his skin for the FBI to bug them. And Ronald Beatty made an escape from Chino, and a guard was murdered. And he went up to Palo Alto in the Bay Area, and he was housed by certain people, Robert Seabook, Bruce Hobson, Gene Hobson, and Morton Newman. He was an escapee wanted on a murder charge of murdering a guard, and these four people were just convicted to long sentences, which means they could have their life in jail. But in the case of four other people being part of a conspiracy to shoot a black school superintendent, they're not even charged. They're not even. This week, Evel Younger called in these people that are involved in this SLA operation for using aliases. He wants them on the grounds that they got driver's license and used aliases for driver's license in California. None of the Watergate people have been indicted for their aliases and their false names and their driver's license that were supplied to them by the CIA. Now, also, besides the bank robbery this last week and the information that the police had foreknowledge of Patricia Hearst, and the memos also, in military terms, they talked about getting the van by a certain date. We also have new information that comes out that links Donald DeFries to the Los Angeles Police Department. Now, for those of you that have listened to my show regularly for the last 2 years, you all know the name Louis Tackwood. He's been on my program. I tell people to read the book, The Glass House Tapes, by Louis Tackwood. It's published by Avon. It's a paperback book. I tell the class I teach at the university or anyone I contact, because it's sort of like if you read Mein Kampf, you knew what Hitler was doing. If you read The Glass House Tapes, you understand the formation in Los Angeles of the criminal conspiracy section of the police department and its links to the attorney general of this state, Evel Younger, who used to be the district attorney in L.A. It connects the police chief, the law enforcement up at Santa Cruz and all over the state to the criminal conspiracy section. It explains the network and how hired provocateurs work. And Mr. Sinque, Donald DeFries, was part of the criminal conspiracy section of the Los Angeles Police Department. He was an agent like Louis Tackwood or Cotton Smith or Ron Karenga. And I'll read an article that came out of the paper this week. It said the raid on the Black Panther Party this week was partly in response to a publication that Sinque, Donald DeFries of the SLA, is related to undercover police work. The Black Panther paper printed a cover story on its April 13th issue, strongly suggesting that Sinque was this police officer. The Oakland raid on the Panthers' office was to get even for them for printing this article, and it gives an excuse to come down and repress the Panthers, which is one of the purposes of letting several members of the LAPD out of San Quentin at this time, on the Steiner brothers, on a phony escape charge, too. The Black Panther paper charged that DeFries was an employee of the criminal conspiracy section of the Los Angeles Police Department. It was in a program that was a pet project of California Attorney General Evel Younger. Younger retained DeFries as his own agent. Don Freed, who published the book The Glass House Tapes, has provided this information that's coming from L.A. Despite reports that Donald DeFries was a homicidal maniac, they had a pressing need for agents from the black community. He worked from the desk of Farwell, who was the black desk that Tackwood was hired to work out of. The Black Panther paper carried Freed's other assertions that the state of California has consistently refused to extradite Donald Freed to New Jersey, DeFries to New Jersey, where he was wanted since 1965. to face charges of kidnapping, extortion, and assault with a deadly weapon. The first known act of connivance with the California police was in 67. DeFreeze was set up as a crime partner, Ronald Coleman, with a telephone call, and he led police to a cache of more than 200 rifles and automatic pistols in Coleman's apartment. And the guns supposedly were stolen from an army surplus store in L.A. DeFreeze and Coleman were released on probation. These are two black men working for the police department, and they had these 200 rifles. They were picked up carrying a fully loaded semi-automatic M68 9 mini rifle. DeFreeze didn't go to jail this time, and 2 years later, he had a shootout out of a bank where he was trying to cash a stolen check. The gun DeFreeze used in this shootout was a .32 caliber Beretta automatic pistol, and the serial number established is one of the guns acquired in the burglary of the War Plus Surplus Store in 67, which means that DeFreeze worked for the police department. He showed him where the guns were, and later he had to be supplied one of the guns that he had turned in. So the LAPD, if it was in their custody and he was using it later, they supplied the gun for the bank robbery that took place in Los Angeles. About this time, Donald DeFreeze was jailed and sent to Vacaville, then a short time to Soledad, and that's where he escaped. But he spent 2 years at Vacaville, where his behavior modification and his brainwashing took place, and he was to meet with Colson Westbrook of the CIA. Now, Donald DeFreeze was an employee of the Los Angeles Police Department, and he was sent up to Vacaville, and more evidence will be coming in every week. And for those who follow this show every single week, you can see the continuity of evidence coming in now. Now, there was another news story this last week about a double for Donald DeFreeze. For those of you who follow conspiracies, we know with the use of the safe house, the alias, arson to hide the operation, and double names and double passports. Well, Donald DeFreeze is in the ilk of Oswald. There were two Lee Harvey Oswalds. One was in a shoe store in New Orleans while the other one was in the Soviet Union. One was at a gun shop getting a scope put on a rifle, and the other one wasn't there. One was getting furniture, and the other one wasn't present. One was at the rifle range. There were two Lee Harvey Oswalds in the Dallas-Fort Worth area and also in New Orleans. In the James Ray case, there was a Mr. Sneed and a Harvey Starvo Galt and a Mr. Bridgman. All three men were doubles, dead ringers for James Ray. And in the Sirian case, a Wayne, a young man by the name of Wayne, was the double for Sirhan in the Ambassador Hotel. Now, the question is, why are there doubles? It appears that a Donald DeFreeze lived in Buffalo, New York, and he surfaced in July. He escaped from Soledad, one of them, in March 73, and the other one surfaced in July in Buffalo, 3 months after the arrest. And the imposter went to the home of a family of Reverend William Foster, where the other Donald DeFreeze had lived and for 6 months in 1959. And the Foster family was suspicious about this imposter. They didn't think he resembled him that closely, but he remembered so many facts about the family that they had him staying with them and for a while until they really got suspicious, because it had been a few years since they had seen the other Donald DeFreeze. In 1959, that was 14 years ago, but he remembered tiny details about the family. So the man, his name is Bernard Keaton, has to know the real Donald DeFreeze. And the question people ask me about why do they use doubles in the conspiracies? And one of the reasons is this. If Donald DeFreeze was selected by the Los Angeles Police Department because of his potential for kidnapping and violence, and if he could get off the rafts by submitting to behavior modification at Vacaville, and didn't meet with agents of the Central Intelligence Agency and was being set up for this kidnapping, which would start a race war and fear linking international and national terrorist guerrillas to this simple, stupid plot out in San Francisco. If they were going to spend this much time and money in L.A. with the PD 3 years and 2 years at Vacaville, you wouldn't put a man in Soledad, then let him out. That's 5 years of training he's had. You wouldn't send them up to Berkeley, where there are plenty of people infiltrating the Venceremos, and DeFries is going to be up there offering to be a hitman. You wouldn't have these men going to Vietnam veterans infiltrating these organizations. And a black man living with these white people and supposedly radicals, some policeman may just pick him up and think something's funny, or some may say he's a hitman, let's put a check on him. And the police department may put a check on him, but if he's an agent, there's a hold. If he works for the FBI or the police department, all he does is pick up a phone and call the FBI, and he gets out. But if some smart policeman picked Donald DeFries up from May, from March, until the Hearst kidnapping in February, the whole thing would be blown, and all their investment in this agent would be gone. So one reason to use doubles, I'm convinced, is that if they pick one up, they can substitute the other, and he would be out on the street. You see, a Lee Harvey Oswald was supposed to shoot John Kennedy at Chicago at the time of the football game, 3 weeks to the assassination that actually did kill him. Lee Harvey Oswald up there rode a car, and it was altogether different trip, but it was still Lee Harvey Oswald who was involved. And the other Oswald was down in Texas working at the book depository at that time, as a standby, like in these crossfires, these assassinations at the Ambassador Hotel, Dealey Plaza, Laurel Shopping Center, where Wallace was shot. There are second guns, there are standbys. You don't rely on one man and one bullet to go to all that trouble. So the second Donald DeFries surfaced this week, and I think that's important to realize it's a part of every espionage operation. Now, San Francisco has been a scene of terror. They call them the zebra killings. The black community is terrorized. They are stopped on the streets if they're a certain size and weight or body build. And then it's injunction to court. Judge is supposed to decide on whether they can do this legally this week. And in the meantime, they've stopped 500 blacks. They not only stopped them, but they have their social security number. And now they carry a card saying, yes, the police have checked me out, because they're now, like South Africa, they're card-carrying blacks. They've passed the test. And this is the beginning of the race war, as I've said on this program, since Dr. Marcus Foster was killed. And the Nazi Party up in San Leandro had foreknowledge. They talked about killing that Mixmaster school superintendent in Oakland. And the Nazi Party was up in San Francisco this weekend, and you saw their uniform in the Chronicle. And they're offering to help find the black people, and they're making their presence known that they have a solution. When you're ready for them, they will step forward. And in the meantime, their services, they would be glad to stop blacks and see which one is the zombie killer. And I'm sure that if they had any foreknowledge of the Foster killing, they could even find the zombie killer if they had to. If it's a police agent or a former mental patient or a former prisoner who has had behavior modification, they could find their selected man and show that the Nazi Party is better than the FBI and the police, and be sure to assassinate in a skirmish a selected man that up till that time had been programmed so that to make sure that he didn't talk. So we have our own vigilantes on the street, and the American Nazi Party is right there and willing to help. I did an article in the Berkeley Barb with another friend, Stephanie, that's out on the stands this week. It says, is Sin Q, that's Donald DeFries, the first black Lee Harvey Oswald. And if you can get a hold of the Berkeley Barb, I think you'll find the article interesting. And it's the third largest article. I did two for The Realist, and we did this one to get it out on the stands because The Realist wasn't ready to go to print. So this one is out now. And if you can get it and read it, I hope you'll find the information interesting to you about my opinions of what the SLA is. And in that article, I mentioned the fact that the SLA is going into a big national and international trip, and they're going to go into all of these kidnappings, which Mr. Hearst says the matter's almost out of his hands because of the kidnappings. And I hope people will call the Civil Liberties Union and tell them to get in touch with me. I think that all over the country, we should have people in every city where we've had these phony kidnappings, because that's what the last 14 were, to investigate just what is going on. Because while I save articles, and I take 8 papers a day talking about many fake kidnappings, a lot of people don't realize, when they read a total of 14 or 16 kidnappings, what is taking place. There was an article today in the paper wrong kidnapping, now a hush-hush. And this is, it said, the police refused to comment on Sunday on the report by a roommate of one of Patricia Hearst's cousins, who said that three black men kidnapped him. And now the Inspector Brown is saying, I've been ordered not to comment. The first story was that the roommate of the first cousin of Patricia Hearst was kidnapped by some black men. And now it seems that they're calling it the snatch that failed, or the wrong kidnapping is a hush-hush. But it seems that the particular man who spread the story, Van R. Bush, 31, he said he was released by a tunnel when the abductors realized that he wasn't William Hearst II. He can't be found. He's disappeared. He's been hazy about the details of the case. He very easily could be a provocateur who's just spreading the stories of multiple kidnappings. So this little kidnapping that was supposed to be a William Hearst II has been hushed up. Now, there was another kidnapping down in Hollandale, Florida, an employee of a bank who told the police that he was kidnapped and held for $60,000 ransom. His name is Albert Danzel. He's 43 years old, and he works at the Citizens National Bank. He claims he was held 24 hours, taken out to the Atlantic Ocean where they wanted him to die, and that he swam back, and the ransom was supposed to be put in a trash can. The FBI says said that they will not report whether or not the ransom was put in a trash can or not, the $69,000. But now they're calling the kidnapping a hoax, and it seems that he swam right back to nine blocks from where his car was parked on the beach. Now, one paper, the Associated Press, could call it a hoax, but the thing goes out as a kidnapping, and there are many papers that report that a blank bank employee was kidnapped for $60,000. And not all of them are going to tell you later, it's a hoax. Now, this same man that was kidnapped at this bank, he was dropped in the water. Another person worked at the bank, was president of the bank of Hollandale, Florida, where he was supposed to have been kidnapped in January. His name is Charles Lance, and he's president of the Citizens National Bank. And there was supposed to be a ransom of $100,000 for him, and he was held in a hotel room. And the article from the San Jose Mercury went on to say no arrests were made in that case. Now, that's like the kidnapping of the banker's wife up in St. Paul, Minneapolis, Minnesota, that didn't get any charges. They kidnapped her and had her gone for several days. She disappeared from a shopping center, and they were not charged with kidnapping. A way to get the Watergate people to talk about what happened was when the judge, John Sirica, gave them 30 or 40 years in jail, and then James McCord said, well, he wasn't going to go to jail. Jeb Magruder was walking around, and all the others were getting off, and he didn't like the stiff sentence, so he started to talk. The one solution to prove that all these kidnappings are fake kidnappings is to insist, look at the kind of trial they had, and insist, for example, that we sit there, the Attorney General Saxby says we should be hard on kidnappers, and Evelyn Younger, the Attorney General of California, says be hard on kidnappers. Why don't we go to every trial of every one of these mini fake kidnappings and see they're all getting off? And they're returning the money, and nothing is happening, and there's even a question that the money came from this man's own bank. Well, the story goes out that we're having all these kidnappings, but the facts behind each one of them shows that they're not true. So if the judges were very strict, for example, if the judge took the kidnapper of Charles Lance, where no arrests were made, and gave him 40 years in jail, he would break down the people who are behind this paramilitary operation and those people who would talk. It's like with the murder of Yablonsky, the labor leader, and his wife and daughter. Three people got a stiff penalty, like the death penalty. And when they began to talk and named another person, that named another person, then they got Tony Boyle, who was finally convicted, who's president of the mine workers. So the way to bring, then you have to go from Tony Boyle up to the Justice Department, because the very first day that Yablonsky was killed, the people that were caught said that it was Tony. They mentioned the name Tony who hired them. So you have to be awfully thick-skinned not to relate Tony Boyle to Yablonsky, considering the feuds that were going on among the mine workers and the election problems that were taking place. So one of the solutions I think that's very important is to give a very stiff sentence to all these kidnappings that have taken place since the first of the year. And then you'd find that these people would reveal who's behind this conspiracy, the kidnapping of Reg Murphy, or even Ian Ball, the man who pulled his car up in front of Princess Anne. Where did he get the $700? Who provided him with the alias? And you'd end this rash of kidnapping, and if you end the rash of kidnapping, then you could ask the president, if he is a president, to remove Attorney General William Saxby for linking all these as being kidnappings or telling Mr. Hearst they're kidnappings when they're not. Now, there was another news article yesterday about a ransom note leads detectives to a boy and his suspected kidnapper in the cities in Auburn. And it tells about an 11-year-old boy who was coming home from school, and he was handcuffed to pipes in the bathroom. He was last seen last Monday, and it was the apartment or home of a man named Roger Miller. So this boy is kidnapped, and the ransom note goes like this. It said he's being held by the Symbionese Liberation Army for $300 million in ransom. Now, that is totally asinine, and all it does is provide a cover story again for these kidnappings that they are going across the nation. They stretch your imagination so far, it's unbelievable that anyone can really fall for this, but maybe they don't take all the papers I take or even read one paper a day. But what happened was they went in and got the little boy who's handcuffed to the bed. How did they find him? Well, it was just a hunch of the investigating officers. They said, the sheriff said that he just had a hunch. This is the newspaper article. As I read the letter, the kidnap letter, it just sounded like something Miller might have to do with it. They're talking about Roger Miller. And he added he knew of Miller and he knew where he lived. So they read a letter and happened to think that, oh, Roger Miller writes like this. This is his style of writing. So they go to his house and find an 11-year-old boy whose ransom is supposed to be $300 million to the Symbionese Liberation Army. This spreading the SLA name around the country to create a system of terror, just like we did in Southeast Asia with our Phoenix program, is exactly what's coming down in this country. Now, there was another article in the paper this week. A bomb rips the office of the Teamsters, causing $75,000 damage in Burlingame, the area close to where Patricia Hearst's family lives. And it says that in Sacramento, Governor Regan said the bombing was part and parcel of the increasing violent atmosphere building up in the country. Now, who's doing the violence? If we opened up all of the trials of the Vietnam veterans, the case up in Seattle, the one in Detroit, Cincinnati, Ohio, Miami, wherever the violence has been investigated for the war demonstrations, it was the FBI that bought the violence in, that bought the guns, the ammunition, and handed it to the agents to make the hippies, the anti-war people, look like they were violent. Now, somebody has to catch on that if all this was true in the conspiracies of the 60s and 70s, that it's also happening here. There was another shootout in Bakersfield where 18 shots were shot at officers. Imagine a massive manhunt in police cars that were gunned down, and these officers can't catch a man who's shooting the police cars. Well, all they lose is a couple of holes in the police car, but look how much mileage you get for that. Now, before we close, I have about 2 minutes to talk about a Jack Anderson article today about Secretary John Connally. John Connally is being named by Mr. Jacobson for being involved in the Milk Fund scandal that's part of the Watergate exposure. John Connally, the article says no whitewash, and what Jack Anderson is saying is Leon Jaworski didn't cover up the part that John Connally had to do in the milk funding, that because he was involved with clients of his, he handed over the investigation to somebody else, and that's how John Connally got caught, that he couldn't cover it up. There's not a whitewash of Connally's involvement. Well, the system's trying to say, look how clean the Justice Department is. Mr. Jaworski is so clean that the prosecution goes through even though he has clients in the milk business or knows John Connally. The fact remains that John Connally was former governor of Texas at the time of the John Kennedy assassination and received correspondence from Lee Harvey Oswald and knew he was an agent of Navy intelligence. And John Connally assigned Leon Jaworski from the CIA Foundation in Houston to protect the interests of Texas on the Warren Commission. And that's what Jaworski did. So when they fired Archibald Cox in Washington, Connally was the one who asked Leon Jaworski through General Haig and Richard Nixon to be the chief prosecutor. So John Connally placed chief prosecutor on the Watergate case when his name has been mentioned in terms of the ITT and the Milk Fund. He had his friend as the chief prosecutor. Now, the fact that Jaworski turned down the prosecution and gave it to someone else is that his clients in Houston are involved with the milk industry. So it was his own relationship, not his relationship to John Connally. But read the article today, because it sounds self-serving that Jaworski is a very honorable investigator in passing the buck. But be that as it may, all the information from Watergate that's coming out is coming out not because the Justice Department or the prosecution is pushing anything at all. It's coming out because certain people don't want to take the rap for somebody else. Jake Jacobson doesn't want to take it for Connally. And that's why it's coming out, not because anyone in Washington is investigating the Watergate. Well, we have 5 seconds to go. Goodness knows what the news will bring next week. But I'm sure it'll be a whopper, and I'll see you at Dialogue Conspiracy next Monday, 5:15.